This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. I am Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castillo. The UN's 22nd Conference of the Parties, or COP22 Climate Summit, was held in Marrakesh, Morocco, just before, during, and after the recent U.S. presidential election. Climate change experts, advocates, and some of the delegates to the COP22 conference have expressed concern over what a Donald Trump presidency, backed by a GOP-led U.S. Congress, might mean to longstanding and future efforts to fight climate change and a U.S. commitment to the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. Right now, it's impossible to determine the exact path a Donald Trump presidency might take regarding U.S. efforts in fighting climate change, since he hasn't even taken office yet. Today, we'll hear from three guests in three segments and get their thoughts, insights, and their prognostications about what might or might not play out, environment and climate change-wise, over the next 4 years of a Donald J. Trump administration. My first guest is Andrew Revkin, who is known for his science pieces for The New York Times. Andrew will soon be taking on a new challenge as a climate reporter for ProPublica.com, which describes itself as an independent, nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. Andrew, looking back at some of the climate change initiatives over the past 8 years of the Obama administration, can you fill us in with some of the accomplishments President Obama has made?
Well, there's different kinds of accomplishments. So those that are on paper, policy moves, and those that where you would actually track what's been happening with emissions or with car mileage or the actual things that are in the span of time have will change the way the U.S. contributes to climate change. On paper, there's been a lot, and there have been significant moves to do what he could do administratively, meaning without Congress, and that's been limited what he can do, but there's a lot of executive actions he's taken, making sure that any projects undertaken by the government consider climate change impacts and energy and that kind of thing. He did work successfully raise the fuel mileage standards going forward for American vehicles of various sizes, and that's pretty significant, although a lot of those steps, you know, again, are kind of subject to what happens going forward. And that doesn't really determine right away what consumers choose to buy. One of the depressing aspects of the car world is that consumers in America are still, I would use the word ridiculously, apt to change their buying patterns as the gasoline price goes up or down even a few cents. The big accomplishment for emissions in the United States has been a reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, the main greenhouse gas, largely because of a shift away from coal toward natural gas in the country's power plants. And that was not the result of government action, at least not some near-term thing. It was the result of the revolution in drilling techniques that has expanded the accessibility of these shale deposits that were once considered untappable. And, you know, this is the fracking reality. The upside of fracking is it's been transformative, and probably for a good time to come as more gas deposits come online. Anytime the oil, the gas price starts to go up, people will be drilling more and hopefully in ways that are less likely to leak. And there's already an encouraging trend there as well. So the main thing that's led to the U.S. having a reduction in CO2 emissions the last 8 years or so has been not the function of government action. He's been actually too slow, as many critics have said, in terms of regulating the emissions from oil and gas facilities. That could get a little worse under incoming administration, for sure, given early hints.
Speaking of the incoming administration, of course, everyone surprised by the election of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States. Now, at this point, all we can do is read the tea leaves, because President-elect Trump hasn't been sworn in yet. But what is concerning those who are pushing for stricter controls to allow for initiatives on climate change to take place?
Well, one of the big concerns was campaign statements he made about coal. You know, there's a number of states still where to get votes there, politicians tend to promise the moon in terms of reviving the coal industry. He also has made speeches about making sure we're drilling for as much natural gas and oil as possible. And you can't kind of have both, because the more natural gas that's available, the less power plants will choose to burn coal. It's basically cheaper. And then on top of that, there are barriers to coal will not be expanding as a source of electricity in the United States again. And Trump has said other things on the campaign trail that, you know, I just wrote about this on .earth, my blog at the Times, about NASA. His main advisor dealing with NASA in recent months has been saying the agency is spending its resources on getting out into space or exploration and less on looking at Earth. Earth science at NASA is in the crosshairs if he sticks with his campaign, with the rhetoric that's been put forward by his advisors in that arena. And that's very troubling for many.
I want to refer to something that took place recently. The president-elect sat down with staff members and reporters at the New York Times, your colleagues, and curious particularly about a question from the New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman. He asked if he was going to take America out of the world's lead of confronting climate change, and Mr. Trump remarked, "I'm looking at it very closely, Tom. I'll tell you what, I have an open mind to it. We're going to look at it very carefully. It's one issue. That's interesting because there are a few things where there's more division than climate change." Comments?
I wish I hadn't been on the road and had been around for that meeting. Well, the first part there, which is about him having an open mind, is the kind of thing that gives some people hope that this isn't a done deal. And I had written, after grist.org, an environmental website, during the campaign, they noticed that back in 2009, when he was a businessman, he signed on to a letter that was a full-page advertisement in the New York Times, pushing for everything that he's since criticized, pushing for an international treaty, for strong action internationally. So that was one version of Donald Trump, and then there was the campaign version. And as you kind of implied correctly, you know, now we're waiting for the presidential version. I think the first part of that statement reflects that there's some malleability there, that depending on the advisors he picks and listens to, there could be some shifts from some of the more stark cartoonish language of the campaign. The second part about divisions on the science, there's a number of things he said, including later at that lunch meeting, that imply that he's not very well versed in the science of climate change, which is not surprising. And one would hope that this is where, you know, the advisors he seeks, and whether he lives up to his pledge and his acceptance speech, to listen to his critics as well. He said he was reaching out for advice to more than just people who share his view. And, you know, if he does that, maybe there'll be some plasticity there too. But as you said correctly at the beginning, it's still kind of to be determined.
Andrew Revkin, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
I appreciate being with you.
That was Andrew Revkin, who was a climate reporter for the public interest news website, ProPublica.com. Joining us now is Mark Bartow, the director of the Energy Institute at the University of Michigan. Mark, my first question to you is, has the climate change debate become too politicized?
Well, I think the politicization happened, you know, some time ago. I think on the right, a lot of this was seen from the early 2000s and after the Nobel Prize as an Al Gore thing. And I think, you know, while Gore did a very important work to bring it to light, just because of who he was, that tended to generate automatic opposition. More recently, we've seen in the U.S., Republicans at least acknowledging that man-made climate change is happening and we need to address it. It remains a pretty polarizing issue, certainly in the U.S. Seems to be much less so elsewhere in the world.
A senior advisor to President-elect Trump said that all climate change research conducted by NASA would be eliminated as part of a crackdown on politicized science. Your thoughts?
That would be a disaster. There's simply no good way to cast that. And I think while people tend to think of NASA's mission as directed outward to the heavens, in fact, a lot of what happens in space has enhanced our understanding of how Earth systems work. And I think it would be nuts to eliminate that. You know, there's a lot of other space activity that happens of direct benefit to everybody in the country, from, you know, our weather satellites to communications to the GPS that everybody relies on. So the idea of NASA as an important platform for planet Earth research and technology from the perspective of space is a crucial one. And I think eliminating some piece of that mission for purely political and egregiously non-scientific reasons would be a disaster.
At the end of October, President-elect Trump outlined what he plans to accomplish in his first 100 days in office. And among those he cited, he plans to cancel billions of payments to the UN climate change programs and use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. Your thoughts on that?
Well, there are certainly some things that he can do to reduce or eliminate funding of the UN and UN climate programs. You know, I think the U.S. has paid about a quarter of the commitment it made under President Obama, and he could, I think, choose not to pay that bill and could choose to withdraw from the Framework Convention. The interesting thing about fixing our air and water infrastructure environmental problems is that the EPA would, of necessity, be right in the middle of that. So in some ways, that may conflict with some of the plans within the administration or its current circle of advisors to significantly downsize and decrease the footprint of the EPA.
You had mentioned the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. What about the recent Paris Climate Agreement that just went into effect a few weeks ago? Would the president-elect be able to withdraw U.S. involvement from this agreement? And if so, what kind of steps would need to be taken?
Well, I think there's the legal piece, and then there's the action piece. So you have to give 3 years' notice of withdrawal, and then there's an additional one-year waiting period. So the U.S. participation in that agreement simply can't be canceled overnight. However, all of the actions are purely voluntary, so we could remain a part of it and simply do nothing. And I think that's probably the more likely scenario.
From an international perspective, what kind of effect would it have for the United States to pull back on climate change initiatives?
Well, I think there are two things, and let me put this in context. The targets of Paris to get as close to no more than 1.5 degrees of warming in this century were ambitious and difficult to begin with. And in fact, it's pretty clear that more would and will have to be done than simply the specific commitments made there. So the impact of the U.S. not playing along is twofold. One, we essentially become a climate rogue, and to the extent that we are a major source of greenhouse gas emissions, China has passed us, so we're only second in the world. That puts an even bigger burden on the rest of the world, but the danger is that if the U.S. goes rogue, then that will lessen the commitment that other nations may feel, because this is not going to be easy under the best of circumstances.
Research has shown that many of those who would like to see climate change initiatives go away really don't trust climate scientists. Some who criticize and express disbelief with scientific reports on climate change say that the scientists are trying to advance their personal or political agendas or trying to get research funds and grants.
You know, it's a charade. They are basically playing by the same playbook as the tobacco companies in the past, and others have written extensively about this, but essentially sowing doubt and putting out a lot of misinformation. A lot of us who have gotten more involved in this area are doing it out of a feeling that it's a critical problem to be working on, in some cases at the expense of doing research in areas that we've been working in before, and I certainly am one of those. So the idea that somehow there's a pot of money in this is just plain wrong. What I have seen in terms of the doubt sowing is very non-scientific approaches to data, you know, cherry-picking data. And yes, there's always uncertainty and there's always noise, and we're talking about global and natural systems, but the trends are just unmistakable. And we're beginning to see, well, not just beginning, but over the last decade, seeing more and more of the effects of climate change on our weather, on the environment. You know, I think we have a great example this week with the fires in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, in the Smoky Mountains. Those are areas that aren't accustomed to being in drought. And again, we're going to see more and more extremes of temperature and precipitation going forward, and this is only going to get worse. So, you know, at what point will the public consciousness of the connection reach the point where people realize that there are human activities behind these changes?
Mark Bartow, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
My pleasure.
That was Mark Bartow, the director of the Energy Institute at the University of Michigan. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Here's a reminder that Encounter can also be heard online as a podcast. Please visit our website, voanews.com/encounter. And we'd love to hear from you, so send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Welcome back to Encounter. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Today, we're taking a look into the future to examine what might or might not happen regarding U.S. involvement with climate change initiatives under the incoming presidential administration of Donald J. Trump. My next guest, who joins us today by telephone, is James Taylor, Senior Fellow for Environment and Energy Policy at the Heartland Institute based in Chicago, Illinois. According to their website, the Heartland Institute's position on climate change has always been that if human emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases pose a threat to the natural world and human health, then actions to avoid the threat would be necessary. But they also say that if the best available research shows that there is little danger or that there is nothing that can be done to prevent climate change, then legislation adopted in the name of stopping global warming should be opposed. James, according to President-elect Donald Trump's campaign website, President Obama's anti-energy orders have weakened the security of the United States, keeping the country reliant on foreign sources of energy. Now, do you agree with this? And if so, how do you see it weakening our security and being detrimental to the best interests of the U.S.?
I do agree with that. By roping off so much federal land from natural resource production, from oil production, from natural gas production, what it means is that we are, first of all, importing more of our energy than we need to be. And second, we are restraining our own production that we could be exporting to other nations. For example, we could be exporting liquefied natural gas to Europe and decreasing their reliance on Russian gas. We could be doing that around the globe and advancing American interests rather than Russian interests or Middle Eastern interests.
Some see possible changes in environmental climate change stances as being economic in nature. Do you see this? And aren't there other advantages of using more fossil fuels such as coal again?
Well, there certainly are economic advantages for affordable energy, if we're talking coal or natural gas or nuclear power or hydropower. All of these are more affordable than wind power and solar power, which are the preferred energy sources of the environmental left. What is real interesting is hydropower and nuclear power are emissions-free. Natural gas cuts carbon dioxide emissions in half versus coal. These are options that conservatives have always supported, but the far left won't discuss them. They impede nuclear power and hydropower and natural gas. I think if they'd been a little more reasonable, when they were controlling the White House and the levers of government, we might have had some of the power sources in place that would alleviate their climate concerns. Now they're going to have a harder time making the case for low-carbon energy sources when they wouldn't compromise and find common ground solutions when they were available.
Some are looking to the future, seeing a revival as coal as a primary energy source once again. What is clean coal? Because I understand that's been used to promote coal energy.
Well, first of all, regarding coal power, it's good for all energy sources if government gets out of the way and allows the market to work. And for coal power, I don't see coal power making a resurgence because natural gas is so inexpensive and so abundant right now and will continue to be so due to the fracking revolution. I think economics and some hesitancy at the state level, where you have public utilities commissions approving or rejecting new power plants, they're hesitant about future government regulations on coal. I just don't see coal power coming back for both regulatory and economic reasons. Regarding clean coal, there is scientifically a way that we can, or different ways actually, that we can pull the carbon dioxide emissions out from coal power production. The problem is the cost. The Congressional Budget Office estimates it adds 76% to the price of coal power, and even that's a guess because we still haven't even perfected the process. But for that price, why not utilize natural gas? Why not utilize nuclear power? Why not utilize hydropower? these are all affordable options that are also very sound for the environment.
Now, environmentalists and those who advocate for stronger climate change policies have sounded the alarm with predictions of what appears to be, to some, an apocalyptic vision of these issues as a result of politics that might or might not be initiated by the Trump administration and the GOP. Is it possible that what we're hearing from those proposing stricter limits on carbon emissions, might this be a bit of hyperbole on the part of the environmentalists, or do some of what they've been saying ring with a bit of truth? Your opinion?
Well, the science, I think, is pretty clear that humans are having some impact on climate. The question is how much and what will be the consequences. And it appears that Donald Trump is giving more credibility to scientists who say the impacts are not that severe and are not that rapid. And in my opinion, that's a correct scientific, well, at least that's where the evidence leads us. However, as I think the environmental groups know, they could have had a compromise solution if they would abandon their wind and solar power only approach, if they would stop obstructing natural gas, hydropower, nuclear power, we would have affordable energy options that also reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
What about the green energy industry? Should efforts in developing green energy be completely abandoned?
Well, I think we need to have a better definition and understanding of what green energy is, because oftentimes people think green energy is merely wind power and solar power, and they forget that wind turbines kill over 1 million birds and bats each year in the United States, including many endangered species, even while producing very little power, and while requiring the development of large stretches of previously undeveloped land. I think if we're looking at green power in its truest sense, we need to include natural gas, we need to include hydropower, we need to include nuclear power, each of which emits either no air pollution or very little air pollution, and I think are actually better for the environment than what we see from wind power.
Looking at both aspects of the climate change debate, what seems to be separating those who are pushing for stricter limits on carbon emissions versus those who think it's kind of an overreaction?
I think there are two issues here. First is the degree to which warming is likely to occur, as well as related consequences. Again, the issue dividing skeptics and global warming advocates is not whether humans are causing some global warming. It's what extent of warming is likely to occur and what are the impacts. And the second issue is economics. If we are told that we need to devastate our economy in order to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, people are going to be a lot less likely to support those measures. However, if people support or people advocate other means of reducing emissions that are affordable, such as natural gas, such as nuclear power, such as hydropower, well, then we can have some agreement. So I think there is an opportunity for discussion and perhaps some common ground policy options, but we need to have those honest discussions in the first place that don't involve vilifying the other side.
What about some of the international efforts in fighting climate change, such as the Paris Climate Agreement? Should we withdraw from the agreement or back away from it, or do you see this as still being a positive thing?
I think the Paris Climate Agreement made things much more difficult for U.S. politicians, U.S. policymakers to implement sound policy for the American people. For example, the agreement calls for a wealth transfer from developed nations to developing nations of $100 billion every year in the name of climate reparations or climate mitigation or climate adaptation. That's simply preposterous. Also, any agreement, any treaty needs to be presented to the U.S. Senate. By choosing not to do so, President Obama merely deepened and widened the divide between skeptics and people who are global warming advocates. I think it would be wise to start a conversation pretty much from scratch and say, look, if we do want to take action, how can we do this in a way that makes sense economically as well as from, you know, different competing scientific points of view? And I think if we look at it that way, I think we can find some policy options that pretty much everyone can agree on.
James Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
That was James Taylor, Senior Fellow for Environment and Energy Policy at the Heartland Institute, based in Chicago, Illinois. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank all of my guests who joined me for today's program. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anya Zaleski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Vasco Vilarich. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel, reminding you to join us again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.